Can I ask you to give a warm welcome to Michael Spence?
There you go.
Fantastic. Michael, thanks for coming.
Not at all. It's a pleasure to be here.
Michael's the president and provost of UCL. He's been in that role for about 18 months?
Slightly less. So we started in January 2021. My wife Jenny and I came from Australia with four of our eight children in December 2020.
Yeah. Jenny, great to have you. Thanks for coming tonight to hear your husband. Great to see you. The fan club have arrived. Fantastic.
I don't know.
And as I say, I mean, it's really kind of you to come because I know you're a busy man, president and provost. What is that all about, president and provost? Is it two different things or do they just like to give you lots of titles?
I think really the latter, but people pretend the former. So they pretend that provost is about running the university and president is about being out in the community and making relationships for the university more generally. I think the truth is that it was always called the provost of UCL. Nobody quite knew what a provost was, particularly in America or China. So okay. They shoved president in.
Now, Michael, I was going to list all of your degrees and diplomas and languages that you speak, but I lost count, basically. I think that you might know everything. That's why
I know very little, and I certainly don't know as much as my wife. So as a fact that she reminds me on a regular basis.
Well, the reason I say it is because I've got to know you a little bit, your neighbours of ours here in Gordon Square. At least three times in the last year, I've found myself starting to explain something to you that you clearly knew more about than me. So I've mansplained the president of UCL. I've kev-splained the president of UCL. The first time was about a building next door I started to tell you about, and you said you just bought the building. The second time I dropped in something about a bit of local history. You said you were reading a book called Historic Bloomsbury.
Victorian Bloomsbury.
Sorry.
I recommend it. It's very good.
And then the third time, this was the one that really got me, was about Scotland, where I'm from, my specialist subject. You've got heritage from Orkney.
I do have heritage from the Orkneys.
So right. I couldn't even tell you anything about my homeland.
You did tell me a lot about
you bested me on my homeland.
So
I couldn't believe it.
All I know about the Orkneys is that lots of people are called Spence.
Oh, really? Okay.
There you go.
Well, there you go. And, I mean, you did all of that very nicely on all of those occasions, so I'm not grumpy about it. But I thought that we would just give you a little bit of a quiz.
Sure.
Just to see if you really do know everything. Okay? So, UCL.
I agreed to do this on the basis that we'd be vaguely pleasant. Yeah, go on.
I'm trying to give you a chance to shine. UCL is also an abbreviation for UEFA Champions League, UCL. Which two teams will play this year's UEFA Champions League final later this month?
No idea. No idea.
I'm no afraid. Idea. Someone no. Tell him.
Not yes! Again.
It, oh, great. None of them know either.
It is a cultured audience.
I was going to say, he's not... Hey, thank you, Liverpool and Real Madrid.
There you go.
Okay, try this one.
Okay.
UCL again. UCL is also an abbreviation for ulnar collateral ligament. That's ulnar, U-L-N-A-R.
Yep.
Michael, where on your body might you find an ulnar collateral ligament?
Your leg?
No, I'm afraid it's your arm. The ulnar is on your forearm.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Sorry. You didn't know that.
I did not know that.
Oh, well, there you go. You've learned something. Michael, we've established you've got some Scottish heritage. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The Orkney Islands, where your ancestors come from, derive their name from the Orcs who used to live there.
Yes.
This is Ork, spelled O-R-K. It's got nothing to do with Lord of the Rings. Right. Don't get excited. O-R-K, what is an Ork?
Good question.
Take a guess.
A seal.
No, it's a young pig, I'm afraid.
There you go. All right.
0 out of 3. Oh, well, you learned something. I'm glad it's been an educational experience.
It has been an educational experience.
There you go. But I get, in all seriousness, I guess you probably do need to know a little bit about
That's a great thing about my job. At 9 o'clock, you pretend to know something about classics. At 10 o'clock, you pretend to know something about astrophysics at 11 o'clock. And you pick enough random bits of information. Pretty soon, you can spin together a tale.
Fantastic.
So, well, I will now say in a meeting tomorrow at some point, yes, of course, that could be because of the ancient pigs in the Orkneys, and people will think I'm clever.
Exactly. Or mention the Champions League.
Mention the Champions
Man
League.
Man of the people, that'll go down well.
Yeah, except it was Liverpool and Real Madrid, was it?
Exactly.
All right. Yeah, I can do that.
Well remembered.
Thank you.
Now, Michael, take us back to Sydney, take us back to you growing up.
Uh-huh.
What was home life like for you growing up? What kind of home was it?
I grew up in a pretty suburban home with a mother and a father and so I have a brother and a sister who are each 5 years apart from me because my mother was very organized and she'd have a baby, wait till that one went to school, have another baby, wait till another one went to school and then have another baby. And then when my brother got to be five, she went out to work. My aunt lived with us, so that was slightly different in that it was good to live in a house with three adults because there was always an alternative point of view to your point of view of your parents.
Mm, that's good. And was faith part of family life and those conversations?
Yeah, very much so. So I grew up in a home, in a Christian home, and was very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have a phase growing up where you walked away from your faith or had major doubts?
So always, really. So I think, so I had an experience of coming to faith when I was sort of five or six or so. But I suppose as you grow, your faith has to grow with you. And I suppose there's never a point at which you're not asking questions about the nature of reality and therefore inevitably about your faith. There are always things that you've got to learn and therefore inevitably always things that you are questioning in one way or another.
Yeah. I mean, you're obviously an intelligent person and you spend your life around a lot of clever people. What persuades you, Michael, that you don't have to leave your brain somewhere off the campus if you're going to believe the claims of Jesus Christ?
So all sorts of things. I mean, I suppose there's a set of arguments about the historicity of the New Testament story, and in various ways I find those compelling. But more than that, I find the Christian account of reality the one that to me makes most sense of the world. And I suppose there are a couple of aspects of it that I find particularly powerful. One is that curious, so the Christian story begins with the claim that the world is somehow broken. And I find that very compelling because the alternatives are either the world is not broken, which is clearly not right, or that the world is just as it is, you know, that things are the way they are, the way they are, the way they are. But we seem to be born remembering that things should be better, and yet they're not. And so I find the Christian claim that things are broken compelling. And I also get that if somebody's going to do something about the brokenness of the world, it has to be God, and that doing something about the brokenness of the world must have implications for God himself. And all of that is powerfully present in the Christian story. And I just find that compelling, the notion that things aren't the way they should be, that we have a sense of the way that things should be, and that somebody's doing something about it, and that the thing they're doing is just not more power, because power seems to be a part of the problem. But that's a whole other story. You were probably expecting a more straightforward answer.
No, that's fantastic. What do you love about Jesus Christ?
That I think he is for me and for the broken.
Do you want to say any more?
So the Christian vision is that if God is, that if there is a God, and if that God is the author of everything, then Alman's minds must be like this, and his mind must be infinitely unknowable, and that therefore he has to make himself known in some way. And the notion that he might not have made himself known in a display of power, but in a display of humility, and that he might have made himself known not in a way that compels belief, but in a way that loves people into believing, I find that very powerful. And so, this endlessly fascinating man who elusively nevertheless seems to show us what God is like, and who by dying, the Christian claim is, takes into himself all the sin and suffering of the world. To me, that's very compelling.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go back to your story for a bit, Michael. So you taught law at Sydney University.
I did.
And then you were over here leading the law faculty at Oxford University.
Yep.
And then back to Sydney eventually to be Vice Chancellor in 2012.
Yep.
Now they say with Vice Chancellors of universities that there's a couple of kind of types. There's the kind of manager type who's good at managing things but a bit functional and doesn't really get the education vibe. And then there's the academic who's great with the love of learning stuff but can't really run anything, especially a big institution. So where are you on that spectrum, or do you reject the premise?
So I reject the premise. I mean, I think a university is a large organization, and it's a large organization that has to work. The trains have to run on time. People have to get paid. Buildings have to get maintained. Students have to get taught. But it's essentially an academic community, and academic communities are most creative when people are given their head to follow their passion. And so you both have to be able to organize the place enough so that things kind of more or less work. And this is the moment for lots of people from UCL to say, well, things don't work at UCL. But for things to kind of work. And on the other hand, you also have to be creating the intellectual environment where both students and staff are free to follow their passions. And so you have to manage, but you also have to be an academic.
Yeah. And you alluded there to kind of the feedback, the criticism that is, I guess, inevitable when you lead such a broad and diverse institution like Sydney University or UCL. And you've had your share of criticism on, on the spectrum of kind of online criticism to hate mail to effigies of you being
burned. I once had to have 24-hour protection because I got death threats from a student. So there you go.
So, I mean, how do you cope with that side of the job? And does your faith in God come into helping you there?
So you have to remember, so there are a couple of things here you have to do. I think if you're going to do any job, whether that job is being a first-year student or being a vice-chancellor, or whether it's being a butcher or a baker or a candlestick maker, you have to remember it's a pretty hopeless source of value and worth. To survive a job, you have to know that that you're valuable, and that you're valuable because you're loved. And I would say ultimately that you're valuable because you're loved by God. And for me, two things are really important. One, always to remember that I'm the vice chancellor now, but there'll be another vice chancellor in some year's time. And somewhere in Sydney, there's a picture of me painted in oil paintings and in oil. And in 20 years' time, nobody will remember who I was. And in 100 years' time, nobody will. But I have value because I am loved by God.
Yeah.
And you also have to remember that you're doing a job and that your value doesn't come from that job. So when people wear the T-shirts that say, fuck Michael Spence or whatever it is, it's not the, they're not really talking about you. They're talking about the vice chancellor. They're talking about the provost. They're talking about the job. They're talking about the decisions you've had to make, lots of which you would rather not make, you know, if money were no object and you're whatever. So there has to be Michael and there has to be the vice chancellor, and you have to have a healthy skepticism about the distance between the two.
Yeah.
And yet do the job with enough integrity so that you never forget who Michael is.
Yeah, that's a very good perspective. We haven't talked about family life yet. Michael, check this out, has 8 children. Is that right?
I do.
That is a biblical proportion of children.
That is not being very good at birth control.
Tell us how, I mean, not how, you, tell us the story of the 8 children. Do you know their names? Maybe we should have a quiz on the children's names.
I do know their children's names. So, although I always call them by the wrong name, one of my children says, just, I only object when you call us by the name of the dog. So the, so I had 5 children with my first wife who I met in Oxford, and she died in 2012, and Jenny and I got married in 2015, and unexpectedly she fell pregnant on our honeymoon, and we had Ted, and then we thought that he needed a little friend, and then this other one came 3 years ago, we know not where from. So we have 3 just lovely little people who make our life great joy.
Yeah.
And who are adored by their 5 older siblings.
Fantastic. And Michael, you mentioned your first wife Beth's death. It sounds like Beth's death was so sudden and just devastatingly out of the blue for you all, and leaving you with 5 children. I wonder, would you mind just saying a little bit about what happened? I think it was November 2012.
Yeah, so she became ill in November 2012 and went into hospital on the 28th of November and was dead by the 22nd of November. And, you know, there were, we were in many, it sounds a funny thing to say, but if a member of your family is going to die, it wasn't a bad way to happen, because it was slow enough so that everybody got to say goodbye, but it didn't drag on and on and on.
And I mean, how did Beth's death affect you spiritually as you look back on that time?
So I just had a sense of God being very present, of God looking after me. And similarly, I think in the circumstances around Jenny and I getting married, we just had a sense of God being in it.
That's fantastic. And Jenny, you mentioned you guys have been married. How many years did you say?
7 years.
7 years, 3 children, and almost 18 months ago, you all you moved over here.
Yes.
To take up this new role in UCL. What attracted you to UCL?
UCL is an extraordinary institution. You know, it is ranked 8th in the world on average. The top 20 in the world have a $25 billion endowment. UCL does not, and that makes it hungry and keen to do well. And there are just so many disciplines in which we're ranked in the top 3 in the world. And it is, you know, this morning we got our research assessment exercise results from the government, and I'm not allowed to tell you anything about those except that they are extraordinary, and it's a great place to be.
All of our UCL students are going, oh, check us out.
No, it is. it's an extraordinary place to be. And both Sydney and Oxford were kind of terminus institutions in their own systems, just a little bit self-satisfied, and therefore could be a little bit smug. UCL doesn't have that. It's a bit scrappy, a bit London. It has a real fighting spirit. And that makes it an extraordinarily creative place. Mm.
Now, Michael, some people weren't happy about you getting the role just because they heard you were a Christian. I don't think they knew anything about what you actually believed or did, but that's quite revealing in itself, isn't it, about attitudes towards Christianity? I mean, why do you think, what are some of the reasons people feel that Christians and the Christian God are intolerant, objectionable?
So I didn't know that about UCL. There you go. So I did know it about Sydney, where it became an issue in the newspapers when I was appointed there, because mm-hmm. both Sydney and UCL were founded as part of the 19th century secular education movement, with the notion that these should be institutions that did not have a church affiliation of any kind. And in fact, Sydney is barred by statute from teaching theology. So it's a part of the foundational. In the 1850s, the founder of the university said that this was a university that was to be open to the disciples of Moses, Muhammad, Jesus, Vishnu, the Buddha, and somebody or other else. Sorry, offending somebody. So they were barred by statute from having a faculty of theology.
So is it a good fit then, godless Gower Street? Is it a good fit to have a clear Christian leading it?
So I think the interesting thing about godless Gower Street, of course, is that that UCL was founded as a place for atheists, but also for dissenters, Jewish people, and Roman Catholics. So it was founded as a place where faith was taken seriously enough, at least by students, that they weren't prepared to sign the 39 Articles of the Church of England to go to university. So it's a different. I think you can have two visions of secularity. You can have a vision of secularity where nobody is able to believe anything, or you can have a vision of secularity that says, you know what, we're a space where everybody is welcome, and not only welcome, but we expect everybody to advance, propose, argue for their vision of the good, and we learn what it means to live in a community where genuine difference is celebrated, and where that means differences of opinion about even fundamental things. And I think UCL is, like Sydney, is a great social experiment in whether or not an institution can be like that, whether or not an institution can be a place where people can genuinely be themselves and genuinely bring different views of the world to their work and nevertheless get on.
And does the social experiment work?
In our good moments, the cultural pressure is against it, is very strong. I think at UCL on the whole it does work.
Hmm. So, I mean, you've talked quite a lot publicly about the role of the university and free speech.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think there are limits on who should be invited to speak at a university? Limits on free speech in that way?
So I have said, and I think it's true, that any lawful speech should be permitted on the university campus, and that any speaker should be permitted on the university campus if invited by staff and students, provided their speech is lawful and provided that there are not going to be, that the police are not saying that there are public order issues that we can't deal with.
So is it kind of then the university is a kind of enabler of free speech?
So I think the university is a forum for debate and not an advocate in debate. And it's kind of complex because obviously we have to have substantive positions in relation to the conduct of our own collective life.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think our job is to host the conversation and to send our staff and students out to, let me give you a Sydney example that I think is how it is when it works well, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but when student protests, or when protests began in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, in the morning at Sydney we had a large, noisy and peaceful pro demonstrator protest, and in the afternoon we had a large, noisy, peaceful pro establishment, so pro Chinese government protest, and in the meantime student leaders from the two groups got together and talked about the situation in Hong Kong. And that's tricky because these are obviously very fraught arguments in which people have a lot personally invested. But the fact that we were able to have people strongly advocating for both sides of that argument and talking to one another and not coming to blows, that seems to me to be what a university should be like.
Yeah. And then thinking about broadening that out to our culture generally, a lot of people are championing diversity and pluralism for all kinds of different reasons, I guess. What would you say, is there a distinctly Christian response to a multicultural society? And where does that Christian response flow from for you?
Yeah, so now I will make a historical claim, a claim in the history of ideas that could be fiercely contested and is probably wrong, but it seems to me there's something to it. I think it's no mistake. I think it is not surprising that liberalism developed as a political philosophy in essentially Christian cultures, because I think the Christian vision starts with the notion that people are autonomous moral agents, that they have capacity, and not only capacity, but the God-given right to pursue that their own vision of the good, and that that's something that needs to be respected. People often want God, however that person, however God is conceived of, to be a bit more controlling, to sort of sort things out, to exercise power to make sure that everybody does the right thing. The Christian vision is a God who exercises a power of a different kind and actually wants to love people into loving, gives people space to make moral choices, to pursue their vision of the good, as he woos them back to himself. That, I think that the liberal conception of living together with difference well is a conception that has deeply Christian cultural roots.
And if that's right, that it has deeply Christian cultural roots, why does Christianity have such a bad reputation so often for being intolerant and people increasingly not just thinking it's untrue, but kind of morally objectionable?
There's an Australian writer who used to say that Christianity was much like the Wangaratta Town Band playing Beethoven's Ninth, that the music is fabulous and the band is pretty crap. and that every now and then the band gets the music right and then it's extraordinary. But a lot of the time, the band's not doing a very good job of playing the music.
Fair enough. And as you look at the way culture is going,
The other thing that also gets a bad rap is, Christianity also has a notion that God does think that some things are good and some things are not good.
Yeah.
And, even that God gets angry about some things.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of hope he gets angry. You know, when I think about things like violence to children, for example, I hope that makes God angry, because it makes the best of the human beings I know angry.
Yeah, that's right. Do you ever worry, as you think ahead 30, 40 years, I mean, will there be space in public discourse for Orthodox Christian views around here?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident about that. And I'm pretty confident about that not because I'm confident not because I'm optimistic about cultural trends or whatever, but because I think God has always had a way of keeping the conversation going. And if he doesn't, he's not God.
Yeah. Just, we're about to wrap up, Michael, but just bring it right down to kind of day-to-day life, you going into the office. How does your faith in Jesus shape you on a day-to-day basis? Do you find time to pray and things?
I read my Bible and pray in the morning, and I pray during the day. I suppose I hope, I would like to think it shapes my leadership in two ways. And I say this with some trepidation because neither of them is exactly right. There's a terrible burden in our culture of perfectionism. You know, you have to be the best and you have to be perfect and you have to have been and you have to be great and you have to work really hard and you have to be really well presented and you have to be cool and you have to look good and you have to get top marks and you have to, there's just our culture values success and excellence. And that's really good, right? But it's a terrible God to serve because it just eats you up. And universities are full of people who want the world to be perfect. And I hope my leadership starts with the fact that we're all pretty broken. It's good to try and do as well as you possibly can. But that in the end, we're all pretty broken. And that that's not a reason for giving up and going home. But it's not a reason for ditching people either. So I hope my Christian faith shapes my leadership by my starting with the notion that I am imperfect, that my colleagues are imperfect, and that on the whole, we're going to try and do the best we can possibly together. And also that in the end, the point is for the work of the university to pursue beauty, truth, and goodness. That the work of the university is to find out what's true and promote it. And that that's a much bigger cause than me and my ego. So that it's not ultimately about Michael is important because he's valued by God. Michael is not important because he's the provost. And I hope that I let myself, that I let that shape my leadership. But, you know, I'm C.1. Yeah. I'm pretty hopeless and I often don't.
One final question, Michael. If there was one thing, you talked about the university being about truth. If there was one true thing about Jesus and the Christian gospel that you would love for the students and your colleagues to know, what would it be? How would you sum up what you would love for them to know is true?
So the thing that I think is true, and if it's true, it changes absolutely everything, is something that even the Apostle Paul said was foolishness to the Greeks and a stumbling block to Jews. And that is the notion that Jesus rose from the dead. If there is a person who has risen from the dead in the sense that Christians mean it about Jesus, that changes everything. And if that's not true, then the whole Christian thing is a load of holy baloney, and I'd give up. So I suppose for me, that's the thing that I think it's important people work out whether or not they think it's true.
Michael, thanks so much. You've just rocked up from a busy day. You didn't really know anything about what I was going to ask you. So thank you for putting yourself under the spotlight. We're really, really grateful. And this is not the end of chat with Michael. I hope already you're starting to think of some questions that you might want to ask him. So let's thank Michael, first of all, for the interview.
Thank you very much.
And you have a seat. And we'll just take a 2-minute break there. Let's just have a breather, just a chance for you to touch base where you're sitting and maybe start to ping in some questions.